Our first case this morning is United States against Sutton. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Conway. I represent the appellant in this matter, Technical Sergeant James Sutton. Your Honor, with the court's permission, I would request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
There are, of course, two issues before this court. The first issue is with respect to the military judge's denial of a motion to suppress oral and written statements on the basis of Article 31. The second issue is a specified issue, and it is that issue that I would like to begin today with, Your Honor. The specified issue asks the question whether the facts charged in the specification are sufficient as a matter of law to support a charge for solicitation of indecent liberties with a child under 134, where the person solicited was that child. I think, Your Honor, that I haven't had 2 months now to think about this specified issue. This is an area where we can clarify the brief to be of assistance to the court. And because of what we viewed as the emphasis on where the language, where the person solicited was that child, I think we tried to approach this question from two perspectives. The first perspective was the broader question, I think, that's being asked there, and that is whether the requested act by the victim, P.S., that is lifting her shirt, would have necessarily required her to commit an offense under the code, the offense of indecent liberties with a child. And the second perspective, I think, that we tried to approach this from is the well-established test for when an offense is adequately alleged, the three-part test, whether there's been notice, whether the elements have been adequately alleged, and whether, together with the record of trial, protects the accused from
Can I ask you just, you break one way or the other, I can guess where you are, but on the question of with solicitation, does the person solicited have to be able to or in fact commit the offense, or is it a question of someone committing an offense? Do you follow?
One of the issues
here between you and the government is does the person solicited have to be capable? Is it them that has to commit all elements of the offense, or just participate in the other person committing the offense?
Well, I think that's an important issue, Your Honor. I think that the essence of the solicitation is that the solicitee would be asked to assume some degree of criminal exposure or criminal culpability. I think that the Harris Court, as the brief state, this has been addressed twice in Conway and Harris, and I think that Harris Court creates this standard where I believe that the government adopts in their brief at page 20, that the solicitee only be asked to participate in conduct she knows is wrongful. And I believe, as a matter of personal opinion, that the Harris Court goes too far, because the problem that they have in Conway is, I think that they adequately state the law of solicitation in Conway. And that is, well, let me back up. I think that in the Conway case, the court seems to assume, without expressly stating, that a child cannot commit, under the age of 16, cannot commit an indecent liberty with another child. In Conway, I think they wind up with this struggle of how do we ascribe to this child her role vis-a-vis the solicitation? What is her role here? What is she being asked to do? And in Conway, they analogize her to that of an aider and abettor, notwithstanding the fact that she's a minor and cannot consent to the act. And I think that's extremely problematic for a number of reasons. One, we're dealing with a child who is under the age of 16, in that case 14. And two, the child's a victim.
Counsel, isn't the basic question here whether or not an individual can be the perpetrator and the victim of the same crime at the same time? And it seems to me that in order for your argument to prevail, that's what we have to have here.
Precisely, Your Honor. And I was thinking by way of analogy this morning, if I were to walk up to somebody on the street and say, give me your wallet, with the requisite attempt to commit a larceny, and the person said no, you wouldn't then suggest that I committed a solicitation to commit larceny and then analogize the victim's role in the offense as that of a participant. In that regard, every victim in every offense is in some way a participant.
What's the difference here? Or is there a difference?
Is there a difference in... I'm not sure that completely follows. I don't know that there's a difference, Your Honor, in terms of how we analyze.
So conceivably, if the military justice system were to have jurisdiction over the minor, the victim in this case, under your theory, the minor could be charged.
I think that's a problem the Conway Court addresses, and I tend to agree with the court there that I don't think that the law of solicitation or Article 34 requires that the victim or the accomplice or whatever you want to call her, that she be subject to the jurisdiction of the court. I think the essence of the solicitation is that the solicitee know that they're about to do something that they could get in trouble for. And I think that's the essence. I hope that answers the question.
If you prevail on that argument, do we get to the second issue? Or the first issue, now the second issue?
No, I don't think you do. And that becomes evident. I think that the motion to dismiss for failure to state an offense is jurisdictional. And I think that even becomes evident on the record. And I was going to get to that later. I will address that now. What happens in this case, I guess I'll move straight to the three-part test, Your Honor, because I think that will help answer your question. And I'm gonna skip to the issue. Well, they're all interrelated here. The first issue is notice.
You've answered my question. You're welcome to argue whatever you want, but you don't have to. And the name of the game is for us to interrupt you as many times as possible so you can't complete a sentence. If you prevail on the solicitation argument, is appellant subject, as a matter of theory, if the government so decides, to prosecution for other offenses related to this, such as attempt or conspiracy or indecent acts or whatever?
Well, I have truly struggled with that question. That's the third part, the double jeopardy. And I think we took the position in the brief with this specification and the record of trial. We took the position that it does not protect them from double jeopardy. But the more I think about it over the past 2 months, and when I take a look at the instructions that the military judge gave on 178 and 179, I'm inclined in all fairness to say that he could plead double jeopardy, and I would hope that that instruction would protect him. So
That out. That's a conclusion without the analysis. Why?
Okay, I'll get there. Why it protects him?
Correct. From something other than solicitation.
Because on 178 and 179 of the joint appendix, the military, and I want to be very clear that I have a problem with the instructions that were given in this particular case. I don't necessarily agree with how they were given, but I think that the law is that the record of trial taken as a whole, including the findings and the instructions, is what you consider in determining whether there's a double jeopardy problem. And on 179, he very clearly, and again, I have a problem with this instruction, but he very clearly gives basically an indecent liberties instruction, though this is a solicitation offense. So I would hope that a military judge would find that he could plead double jeopardy here.
Counsel, the stepdaughter in this case had been 18 years old and a member of the Air Force, could she be prosecuted for indecent liberties under the facts of this case?
Well, as I understand it, the indecent liberty, well, maybe not an indecent liberties. As I understand it, the offense is captioned indecent liberties with a child. If under the facts, assuming it's two airmen of the age of consent, I would think not indecent liberties, but perhaps any number of other offenses. So I would go now to back to the elements here. The first is the notice, the issue of notice. And I wanted to clarify our brief. I think it appeared internally inconsistent. At one point, we suggested that he was provided notice that it was a solicitation to commit an indecent liberty. And then we concluded for purposes of pleading that there was no notice. And I think part of the problem you have in this case is that the defense files a motion to dismiss for failure to state an offense, stating that it's a solicitation to commit an indecent liberty, and then you've got trial counsel on the motions hearing saying, no, this is an indecent liberty, it's not a solicitation offense, and he later says on the argument on the instructions that the solicitation was a term of art. Well, at the motions hearing, the military judge doesn't really resolve these two different worldviews of what the specification alleges. The military judge concludes that, well, it states an offense under the general article 134. So now we go into the pleading stage where there are really three different worldviews of what this specification is. And by the time you get to the argument on the instructions, the military judge realizes, and this segues very nicely to the second part of the test, the elements part, that he's got a problem. He doesn't know what the elements are. And this starts to become evident on the record of trial. Just let me be precise. We start to look at that on page 168, Joint Appendix 168. We have this discussion on the instructions in which the judge says, hey, we're going to help us. The defense, again, it essentially renews their motion to dismiss. The judge says, if this is a solicitation offense, then the government's got a problem because the victim here is not being asked to commit an offense. And the government restates their view. This is after the close of evidence. The government restates their view that this is an indecent liberty. So the military judge denies the defense's request to get the solicitation instruction. They go into an 802, and trial counsel contacts the SJA. This is all on the record. And the SJA says, no, this is a solicitation charge. So the judge backtracks. Notwithstanding on page 168, and he says, look, the government's got a problem. This is a solicitation charge. He now has essentially decided that he's going to give the solicitation charge. So I think that at that point, the military judge probably should have dismissed the case for failure to state an offense, given what he had already said on the record. Having said that, he basically says that he's going to customize the instructions. And that's where we get into the second part of the test, the elements, which I think is problematic here. After 2 months of thinking this, I am hard-pressed to be able to articulate to this court with any degree of precision what exactly the elements that should have been alleged are. And the elements, as I previously said, are on Joint Appendix 178 and 179. On Joint Appendix 178, he gives the elements for solicitation, and I don't necessarily have a problem with what he instructed the members on. On Joint Appendix 179, he tells the panel that it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused intended PS to commit every element of the offense of engaging in indecent liberties. But then it seems to me from reading the elements that he instructed on that he's unclear as to what they are, as am I. And that's the problem with this offense. And the elements that he ultimately instructs her on have everything to do with his actions and not hers. So I think that it's a confusing instruction. So I think that addresses the second part. It would be elements. Thirdly, I've already discussed the issue of double jeopardy. So at this point, I would use my remaining time to discuss issue one, which I think is...
Counsel, could you speak up a little more?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
My apologies. At this point, I would use my remaining time to briefly discuss issue one, which I think is a much simpler issue. First, I want to correct the brief and apologize to the court. I think the standard of review cites Article 66, which is clearly incorrect. But both parties agree on the standard of review here that you're reviewing your findings of fact, clearly erroneous, and conclusions of law de novo. Having said that, this is not an issue where we're asking the court to, we're arguing over construction of law. We're simply arguing the application of the facts to the law. And I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, so I will stand on the brief. But before I do that, I want to talk about the agency issue with respect to the Article 31 issue, the issue of agency. And I want to call the court's attention to where I'm hanging my hat to argue that the OSI was using the civilian investigator as an agent. And that's that Joint Appendix, I'm sorry, Appendix 38. I think it's very clear the test is well settled, indivisible entity, and, you know, in furtherance of any military investigation or in any sense an agent of the military. On Joint Appendix, Joint Appendix 37, this is with respect to the agency question. Trial counsel on cross-examination asks Agent Sackett, the OSI agent, but OSI still had an interest because obviously Technical Sergeant Sutton was in the military, and Agent Sackett's response is, well, when we sat down and talked to Sergeant Sutton and Investigator Wilson conducted the interview, she was the lead at that point, and I think all the agents agree on that. But then trial counsel asks this agent, why do you say she was the lead at that point? And Agent Sackett's response is, well, the procedures that are used to interview someone who has allegations of criminal activity are different from the military, as they are different for the from the outside world. And then he's interrupted, and trial counsel asks him another question. And
well, which way does that cut? If they're different, and she's following hers, doesn't that cut in the direction of two separate investigations?
Well, I think that cuts into, here's the problem, I think. This case, OSI.
Did the OSI agents ask a single question during this interrogation, assuming it's an interrogation?
Of course, Your Honor. And I don't think there's any evidence on the record that they asked any questions.
Okay.
They were simply taking.
Is there any evidence on the record that they got together ahead of time and told her what to ask?
No, Your Honor, but there is evidence that they participated in every part of the investigation up to that point. So when we interview the victims, we're going to call this an OSI investigation. When we interview the accused, because the procedures are different, we're going to call it a Tom Green County investigation, and I think that subverts Article 31. And I think that what he's really saying here is that the procedures...
Well, did they say that? In other words, was there any evidence that the OSI and Ms. Wilson said, we're going to do part of it as an OSI investigation, we're going to do part of it as a Tom Green investigation? Or are these after-the-fact perspectives on what happened?
I think that they're plainly after-the-fact perspectives. I think that night, it's the middle of the night, and she actually uses the term, we decided to go and interview him, and she uses it in a very editorial sense, I think. I think they collectively get together, and they decide to finish the investigation that night. The next day, they go back, and they search the house, and OSI goes with them. So everything up to this point is
there true. Anything on the record that establishes that there were separate investigations that took place here in terms of any express statement made by any agent at the time of the investigations?
I think on January 6th, so the interrogation is on January 5th. On January 6th, OSI does a memorandum on the record indicating that Tom Green County has the lead. But this, as far as I know, is after... and I see that my time has expired.
You can answer that question. Is there anything on the record in which those agents say that at the time of the interrogation, we decided or the agent decided from the county that this was going to be either a separate or a joint or anything about the investigation itself?
Yes, sir. And I think the answer to that is there is, and it occurred after the interrogation of appellant.
Thank you.
In your view, as a matter of law, can there be parallel investigations, or does it have to be either indivisible or separate?
I think that there can be, and I think that there certainly have been cases where there were parallel investigations. I think the court's primary concern has been preventing military agents from subverting the intents of Article 31, and I think that's the inquiry. But yes, Your Honor, I think there can be parallel investigations. The question is whether the agents are using another agency to get around the rights advisement requirement under Article 31.
So parallel is okay if they're separate?
Under certain circumstances, yes. I think that there's nothing to prevent law enforcement agencies from sharing information.
What about being in the same room together? Are you arguing the fact that they were all there together equals indivisible, or are putting aside, if that were all there was there, would that be a parallel investigation, or is that a QED and indivisible, or whatever, joint investigation?
I think there's some, if that were all there were, then it would be, and there are.
That's all I'm asking. It's not a trick. It's
okay.
If that's the only fact.
Then... Yes, Your Honor, I would concede that if that's all there was.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Captain Joseph Kugler, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Weber, I represent the United States in this matter. Like the appellant, I would like to start with the specified issue and then move to issue one. With regard to the specified issue by this court, the appellant requested PS to expose her breast to him for $20. He invited P.S. to join in a criminal venture where she herself was the victim.
Why wasn't it charged like that? If we take a look at the charge, would this be a valid charge? Wrongfully asked his dependent daughter, P.S., a female under 16 years of age, to lift her shirt and show him her breasts for $20 or words to that effect with intent to gratify the lust of the accused. Would that be a valid charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is the solicitation to engage in indecent liberties add to this?
I'm not sure that because there is an alternate way that would also be correct in charging it, I don't think answers the question whether this charge
is. I'm not asking whether it's an alternate in terms of isn't that what happened here? That he asked her to lift the shirt to gratify his lust.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And why wasn't it charged that way?
Your Honor, it very well could have been charged that way, but I think the way that it is charged now, and perhaps it would be simpler analysis if it were charged that way, but the way that it's charged now is still a correct offense under solicitation in the government's view.
What are the elements of indecent liberties with a child?
The elements of indecent liberties with a child. That the accused commit a certain wrongful act with a certain person, that the accused commit a certain act upon the body of a certain person, that the person was under 16 years of age and not the spouse of the accused, that the act of the accused was indecent, and that the accused committed the act with the intent to arouse, appeal, or gratify the lust or passions or sexual desires of the accused.
Okay, and now we're shoving it back one step to solicitation. Is this a solicitation offense? Is this an indecent liberties offense? Or is this just indecent language?
Well, that is a confusing aspect of this charge because by the very nature of soliciting a child to do this, it's indecent language and it's an indecent liberty. So in committing the offense of solicitation, he's also committed the offense.
Well, if it's that confusing, how can the accused defend against it?
Well, the accused can defend against it, and that was the issue the appellant brought up with regard to notice, and did defend against it. In arguing about what was to be charged, the defense, trial defense, stated that he understood this all the time to be a solicitation to commit an indecent liberty with a child.
Okay, I can conceive of a fact situation where this charge might fit. Say you had an accused who was a voyeur, who got his sexual pleasure from watching children engage in sexual acts with each other. And he asked child A to try and entice child B to engage in some sort of mutual sexual act. That might be solicitation to engage in indecent liberties or acts, depending on what happened. But asking your stepdaughter to show her breasts is something totally different. She's the victim.
And that is, again, the confusing aspect of this, that the child is being asked to essentially victimize herself. And what's confusing about this is that for her to commit the offense or for the offense to occur, it's interdependent with the intent of the solicitor. In other words, if he doesn't have the intent to satisfy his lustful desires, she can't complete the offense of indecent liberties with a child by lifting a shirt. But that interdependency is not foreign to the solicitation realm. In United States versus Oakley, when they ask an individual to go and get rat poison, the question is innocuous unless you consider how that plays with the intent of the person asking the question. And that is why this court has held that it must be known by the person who's being asked to do the act that the act is in fact wrongful.
Well, is there anything on the record that shows that the girl knew that the act was legally as opposed to morally wrongful?
Legally per se, no. But the court below went through what it was that in the record that showed that she knew it was morally wrongful. She cried.
Well, but what's the criterion? I mean, if knowing an act is wrongful in the sense of the law has nothing to do with morality, does it?
No, but I don't think this court, or I don't think the law requires that the person being asked a question go through a legal elements test, but know instead that what they're doing is wrongful. And to give an analogy that answers the question of whether or not you can be asked to commit offense against yourself, Pellet proposed the analogy of asking someone to give me your wallet. Well, you know, this is closer to asking another person to burn your house down. If I want to commit an arson and I ask another individual, burn your house down, that person needs to burn the house of another in order to commit an arson. But when I ask you that together, if you were to acquiesce to what I had asked you to do, arson would have been committed. And that is the analysis that's taken in Conway and Harris and the analysis that the government would urge this court
to take. Wait a minute. If you ask another to burn his house down,
right,
and he does so, how's that arson on his part?
Well,
you can burn your own house down if you want to. It may cause the fire department problems, but it's your house.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you were able to induce someone to commit a crime, you're completing the criminal venture. And that is the analysis.
But I don't see how it's a crime in your hypothetical.
Because of the intent of the solicitor to burn someone else's house down. I know it was the only analogy I could take outside of the child realm, and perhaps it's easiest to look at it within the realm of children as it was in Conway and Harris, where an adult asks a child to either leave a keyhole open or leave the shutters open so that person, the solicitor, can complete their criminal venture, which is the intent to see the child in the nude for lustful purposes. They are essentially, as was discussed in Conway, aiding and abetting the crime that the solicitor wants to commit. And so the government's position is that that is, in fact...
Okay, to repeat the Chief Judge's question, if the minor were 18 and in the Air Force, could she be charged as an aider and abetter?
If
the girl involved were 18 and in the Air Force, could she be charged as an aider and abetter?
No, if she was 18 and she had...
Well, of course, it wouldn't be with a
consent,
child.
But the child is unable to consent in this case, so it's the resulting...
Well, if the child's unable to consent, how can the child be an aider and abetter, which requires some positive action?
Right, and the government's position is that a person can commit a crime or engage in crime or complete a crime for the solicitor without themselves gaining criminal liability. And I don't believe criminal liability is the touchstone to a solicitation offense, because one can ask someone who is an undercover agent to commit an offense, and that's a valid solicitation. One can ask a person who is outside the jurisdiction of the UCMJ to commit an offense, and that's a valid solicitation. So the issue is not, will we be dragging children into a court of law, but is what they're being asked to do, if they were to do it, does that result in the commission of a crime? And if she had done that, lifted her shirt for the purpose of satisfying his lust in return for $20 after her younger sister had been sent out of the room, that certainly would have been the completion of an offense, indecent liberties with a child. He would have been the person criminally liable, but the offense would have been committed. And it's this analysis, I think, that we're asking the court to adopt the Conway and Harris analysis, that it's not whether or not the person is being asked to commit an offense that they're solely criminally liable for, but whether or not they're joining in a criminal venture and that they recognize that what they're being asked to do is wrong or contributes to that crime. If this court...
So you would agree the distinction between you and appellant is that in your view of the solicitation, it's commission of any crime, and in the view of the appellant, it's a commission of a crime by the person who has been asked.
Correct, Your Honor. And essentially...
And so we either break one way or the other.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In United States versus Conway, I think in the dissent, they point out that distinction. And in fact, the judge there says that if he had his druthers, that's the way it would cut, but he doesn't see it that way. So again, I think that is the question, which way this court will cut on that issue. Should this court find that the individual being asked needs to have an independent criminal liability, it could be affirmed under a lesser included offense of solicitation of indecent acts with another. Certainly there isn't that codependency. She's being asked to lift her shirt up for the benefit of the lustful desires of the accused. So if this court were to cut against us on that issue, we would request that you affirm under solicitation of indecent acts with another, which is a lesser included of solicitation of indecent liberties with a child. And we believe all the elements have been covered in order for them to have found her guilty of indecent acts, indecent liberties with a child. They necessarily would have had to find the required elements of indecent acts with another.
If we find for the appellant on two, do we have to reach one?
If you find for the appellant on
two.
Issue two.
Right. Do we have to reach one?
If you find for the appellant and do not, and
do not affirm on the LIO.
Not affirm on a lesser included, then no, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I don't believe you do. Moving now to the second issue, or in this case, the first issue. Detective Diane Wilson conducted a non-custodial interview of the appellant for the district attorney's office without the direction, without any direction from the Air Force. At the point the interview occurred, it was a civilian investigation that required no Article 31 rights advisement.
How do we know at that point that it was a civilian versus joint versus parallel versus something else?
Yes, Your Honor. And there is no express pronunciation by anyone involved, either of the parties, to say, you know, now this is going to be a civilian investigation. There isn't that. And in fact, the government would say that if there was such a thing, it would be more likely that that statement would only be made for purposes of subterfuge. The way that you look at it, and the way the courts have said you need to analyze this, I believe, is to look at the objective facts. What's going on in the investigation? And so you look at the role of the parties, and in looking at the two prongs, there's only two questions, really. Investigations, have they merged indivisibly, or is the civilian person acting as an agent of the military? And so looking first at whether or not these investigations are merged, obviously you need to look at the factors that are discussed in Lone Tree. What's the purpose of the investigation? Is there independent action on the parties? And is the civilian seeking any guidance or advice from the military in any way?
Counsel, I wonder if this case asks us to look at it a different way, and that is cases where we've had merger, we've had separate entities, and a question of whether they've come together. So I understand the record here in the military judge's findings. Case began with the Air Force OSI asking the civilian agent to participate in their investigation. So then isn't the question, did they diverge, as opposed to whether they merged?
Your Honor, you're correct in that it was initiated by OSI. But I would describe OSI's involvement in that context almost as a notification. This wasn't a well-worked-up case by OSI that was later joined by the local authorities. After 4 or 5 days of beating the pavement, they invite the expert to interview a child. When they received the notice from the legal office, they immediately called Diane Wilson. And Diane Wilson was actually there before Special Agent Sackett even arrived on the scene.
I understand that, but what in the record would show that they called her for the purpose of having her conduct a Tom Green County investigation?
There is no express statement of that
Aren't the findings of fact to the contrary, that is, they called her to have her assist in their investigation because they had a level of discomfort as to their own expertise with respect to this area?
Correct. The military judge found that at the outset it was OSI was requesting their assistance. Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't our question here whether they diverged to the point at the time of the interrogation, had they diverged to the point where they were separate?
And I suppose that's That's a fair way to frame the issue, yes, Your Honor. And I think the objective facts support the military judge's findings that they had diverged, using the same criteria that is used in Moultrie. And the divergence took place very quickly. She stated on the record, Diane Wilson stated on the record, that her interest was, once she realized, as she interviewed the mother, once she realized that this had occurred downtown, she treated this as her investigation. And the independent facts show that she did treat it as her investigation. You can see that because she is the one who contacts the appellant, independently of any input of OSI. She is the one who coordinates with him. In fact, Special Agent Sackett is really unaware of how the appellant was contacted at all, any of the details of the arrangements, because she independently made all of those arrangements. And then,
didn't she then bring them into the process at that point, or continue their involvement in the process by ensuring that they were there when he was picked up and transported to the district attorney's office?
I think that the military judge accurately described their role as mere observers in his findings of fact, and I think that bears out in the record, as Sackett, Special Agent Sackett, says that he followed her, he watched. He wasn't even sure if the appellant was patted down, and then he sat in there, and neither one of the OSI agents asked a single question or gave a single question to Diane Wilson to ask.
And so what role does the perspective of the suspect have in this matter? That is, when the suspect is being interviewed, do we look at this from the point of view of the interrogators, or the point of view of the person being interrogated, or both, with respect to whether Article 31 warnings are required?
Your Honor, I think it's important to look at both perspectives, and I think if you were to look at the perspective of the person who's being interrogated, his perspective begins at the time in which his interrogation begins. In other words, he doesn't know who contacted who to begin the investigation or any of the background. All he knows is that two OSI agents are there, and their role was mere observers at that point.
Was it stated, or is that simply what you would derive from the findings of fact by the military judge? In other words, did at any point did the civilian investigator say, these people are just here to watch, they're not part of this investigation?
I don't believe there's anything in the record to say that was stated. In fact, the question of whether or not the OSI agents were introduced as OSI agents is speculated on by both Diane Wilson and the OSI agents, saying that would have been typical, they expect that it happened, but even that is not entirely clear in the record itself.
Did any of the people participating in the investigation have the authority to determine whether the case would be prosecuted in civilian or military court?
I don't believe so. I don't believe they had the final say in that determination, Your Honor. However, there have been cases before where United States versus Jones, where the German police are interviewing a suspect for their own purposes, looking out for the interests of the German community. In United States versus Pinzon, where the Iceland Police Department is looking out for their interests, there doesn't need to be a statement beforehand. And ultimately, if it winds
in, up... In either of those cases, were military investigators present during the interrogation?
In United States versus Jones, I don't believe there were, but in the cases that are discussed within United States versus Jones, there certainly were. I believe it's United States versus Plant that's discussed in Jones, where they have people acting, military members acting as translators for the police, and yet that role isn't enough to change this into a military investigation. And my time is almost about to expire, but briefly touching on the agency.
And you may take the time you need to complete your point and then summarize your case.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly touching on the agency argument, I think the degree of control is what needs to be looked at to answer whether or not there is any aspect of agency in this case. Clearly, more clearly than the first point, the actions of Diane Wilson were completely independent of any control by OSI. And the inference that the appellant gives that this was somehow a subterfuge in order to get unadvised statements into court is belied by the fact that ultimately the accused was indicted initially in Texas, and that all the follow-up investigations, including the processing of the evidence that was seized later that day, was done through Texas, and never did the evidence even wind up in the hands of anyone in the military until after the process had completed in the Texas courts. So to summarize, Your Honor, no Article 31 rights were required because a civilian investigator acted independently pursuing her own investigation without direction or control by anyone in the military. Further, the charge of soliciting indecent liberties with another is legally correct because it asks a child to join in a criminal venture as described in the United States versus Conway and Harris. And that criminal venture was the criminal venture of the appellant. Furthermore, even if this court were to find that a person could not solicit someone because they need to be independently criminally liable, we would urge you to affirm under the lesser included offense of solicitation of indecent acts with another. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Of solicitation of an indecent act with a minor would be highly prejudicial to introduce into this a fourth worldview that the defense never, I'm not even sure that it was instructed upon as a lesser included offense. I would have to check the record of trial, but I would certainly take objection to any affirmance on the lesser included offense, particularly on this record of trial, given the confusion that was present.
Well, about the primary offense, why, as a matter of law, should it be inappropriate to convict a person who asks another person to participate in a criminal act in the way charged in this case, even if the person who is receiving the request can't be independently charged? Why, as a matter of law, is that inappropriate?
Well, as a matter of
in other words, what's the problem with the charge here? I understand the arguments that have been made about how other cases should be interpreted, et cetera. Bottom line, what's the legal problem with charging this charge?
I think it goes back to the underlying policy underpinning solicitation law and even the concerns in Higgins with respect to the innocent agent problem. From Higgins, and I'm even inclined to think that the government's position here would ask the court in some regard to revisit their thinking in Higgins. But I think the essence here of the solicitation is exactly that I stated at the beginning, that the person must understand. It's not a solicitation unless the person understands that they're creating a criminal offense. Otherwise, you've got the and if they be exposed, otherwise you've got the innocent agent problem from Higgins.
You may conclude.
I have nothing further to add. I will rest on the brief for the rest of the issue one issues.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you for your presentation today. We thank both counsel for the presentation. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.